Chapter 7. I went into the library. It is a moment that I shall always remember. And took a novel of Walter Scott's, St. Ronan's Well, the only one of his novels I had not read. I remember that a poignant, indefinite misery made my heart ache, as though with foreboding of trouble. I wanted to cry. There was a bright light in the room from the slanting rays of the setting sun, which was streaming in at the high windows onto the parquet floor. It was still. There was not a soul in the adjoining rooms. Pyotr Alexandrovitch was not at home, while Alexandra Mihailovna was in bed, ill. I was actually crying, and, opening the second part of the book, was aimlessly turning over its pages, trying to discover some meaning in the disconnected phrases that flitted before my eyes. I was, as it were, trying my fortune, as people do, by opening a book at random. There are moments when all the intellectual and spiritual faculties, morbidly overstrained, as it were, suddenly flare up in a bright flame of consciousness. And at such an instant, the troubled soul, as though languishing with a foreboding of the future, with a foretaste of it, has something like prophetic vision. And your whole being so longs for life, so begs for life, and aflame with the most burning, blindest hope, your heart seems to summon the future with all its mystery, with all its uncertainty, even with its storms and upheavals, if only it brings life. Such was that moment. I remember that I had just taken the book to open it at random again, and, reading the first page that presented itself, to divine the future from it. But as I opened it, I noticed a piece of notepaper, covered with writing, folded into four and pressed as flat as though it had been laid in the book years ago and forgotten in it. With extreme curiosity, I began examining my find. It was a letter with no address on it, signed with the two capital letters S.O. My interest was redoubled. I opened the paper, which almost stuck together, and from long lying between the pages left a clear imprint upon them. The folds of the letter were worn and frayed. One could see that it had at one time been read and reread, and kept as a precious treasure. The ink had turned blue and faded. It had been written so long ago. A few words caught my eye by chance, and my heart began beating with expectation. In confusion, I turned the letter over and over in my hands, as though purposely postponing the moment of reading. I took the letter to the light. Yes, tears had dried, had dropped on those lines. The stain remained on the paper. Here and there, whole letters had been washed away by tears. Whose tears were they? At last, breathless with suspense, I read half of the first page, and a cry of astonishment broke from me. I shut the book, put the book back in its case, and, hiding the letter under my shawl, ran to my room, locked myself in, and began reading the letter again from the beginning. But my heart was thumping so that the words and letters danced and flitted before my eyes. For a long while I could make out nothing. In the letter there was a discovery, the beginning of a mystery. It struck me like a flash of lightning, for I learned to whom it was written. I knew that I was committing almost a crime in reading the letter, but the moment was too strong for me. The letter was to Alexandra Mihailovna. This was the letter. I will reproduce it here. I vaguely understood what was in it, and long after was haunted by conjectures and painful surmises. My heart was stirred and troubled for a long time, almost forever, for much was called forth by this letter. I had truly divined the future. It was a farewell letter, the last and terrible. As I read it, I felt a painful tightening of the heart, as though I myself lost everything, as though everything had been taken from me for ever, even my dreams and my hopes, as though nothing more were left me but a life no longer wanted. Who was he, the writer of this letter? What was his life like afterwards? There were so many hints in the letter, so many facts, that one could not make a mistake. So many riddles, too, that one could not but be lost in conjectures. But I was scarcely mistaken. Besides, the style of the letter, which implied so much, implied the whole character of the tie through which two hearts had been broken. The feelings, the thoughts of the writer were laid bare. They were of too special a character, and, as I have said already, implied too much. But here is the letter. I am copying it, word for word.
"You will not forget me. You have said it. I believe it, and all my life henceforth is in those words of yours. We must part. Our hour has struck. I have known this for a long while, my gentle, my sad beauty, but only now I understand it. Through all our time, through all the time that you have loved me, my heart has yearned and ached over our love, and, would you believe it, my heart is easier now. I knew long ago that this would be the end, and that this was destined from the first. It is fate. Let me tell you, Alexandra, we are not equals. I always felt that, always. I was not worthy of you, and I alone ought to bear the punishment for the happiness I have known. Tell me, what was I beside you till the time when you came to know me? My God, here 2 years have passed, and I seem to have been unconscious of it till now. To this day I cannot grasp that you have loved me. I don't understand how we came to that point, how it began. Do you remember what I was compared with you? Was I worthy of you? In what did I excel? In what way was I particularly distinguished? Till I knew you, I was coarse and common. I looked sullen and dejected. I desired no other life, did not dream of it. I did not invite it, and did not want to invite it. Everything in me was somehow crushed, and I knew nothing in the world of more importance than my regular daily work. My only care was the morrow, and I was indifferent even to that. In the past, it was long ago, I had a dream of something like this, and I gave way to daydreams like a fool. But a long, long time had passed since then, and I had begun living in solitude, calmly, gloomily. I actually did not feel the cold that froze my heart. And it slept. I knew and made up my mind that no sun would ever rise for me, and believed it, and did not repine at anything, because I knew that so it was bound to be. When you crossed my path, I did not understand that I could dare to raise my eyes to you. I was like a slave beside you. There was no tremor, no ache in my heart when I was by you. It told me nothing. It was unmoved. My soul did not recognize yours, though it found new light beside its fair sister soul. I know that. I felt it. Dimly. That I could feel, since the light of God's day is shed on the lowest blade of grass and warms and cherishes it, even as the gorgeous flower beside which it meekly grows. When I learned all, do you remember? After that evening, after those words which stirred my soul to its depth, I was dazed, shattered. Everything in me was troubled, and, do you know, I was so overwhelmed, and had so little faith in myself that I did not understand you. I have never spoken to you of that. You knew nothing of that. I was not in the past the same as you have found me. If I had been able, if I had dared to speak, I should have confessed it to you all long ago. But I was silent, and I am telling you everything now that you may know the man you are leaving, the man from whom you are parting. Do you know how I understood you at first? Passion caught me like fire, flowed in my veins like poison. It confused all my thoughts and feelings. I was intoxicated. I was as though possessed, and responded to your pure, compassionate love, not as equal to equal, not as one worthy of your pure love, but without understanding, heartlessly. I did not recognize what you were. I responded to you as to one who, in my eyes, had forgotten herself to my level, and not one who wanted to raise me to hers. Do you know of what I suspected you? What is meant by those words, forgotten herself to my level? But no, I will not insult you with my confession. Only one thing I will tell you. You have been cruelly mistaken in me. I could never rise to your level, never. I could only contemplate you in boundless love without ever coming near you. My passion exalted by you, was not love. I was afraid of love. I dared not love you. Love implies reciprocity, equality, and I was not worthy of them. I don't know how it was with me. Ah, how can I tell you that? How can I make myself understood? I did not believe it at first. Oh! Do you remember when my first excitement had subsided, when I could see things clearer, when nothing was left but a pure feeling purged of all that was gross? My first emotion was one of wonder, confusion, alarm, and do you remember how all at once I fell sobbing at your feet? Do you remember how, troubled and frightened, you kept asking with tears, what was I feeling? I said nothing. I could not answer you. But my heart was rent. My happiness weighed upon me like an unbearable burden, and my sobs seemed to whisper to me, why is this? How have I deserved it? How am I deserving of bliss? My sister, my sister! Oh, how many times, you did not know it, how many times I have in secret kissed your dress, in secret because I knew I was not worthy of you. And I could hardly breathe at such times, and my heart beat slowly, as though it meant to stop and swoon for ever. When I took your hand, I turned pale and trembled all over. You confounded me by the purity of your soul. Ah, I cannot tell you all that has been accumulating in my heart and craving utterance. Do you know that at times your compassionate, everlasting tenderness was a burden and a torture to me? When you kissed me, it happened once, and I shall never forget it. There was a mist before my eyes, and my whole spirit swooned in one instant. Why did I not die at that moment at your feet? Will you understand what I am trying to say? I want to tell you everything, and I tell you this. Yes, you love me very much. You have loved me as a sister loves a brother. You have loved me as your own creation, because you have raised my heart from the dead, awakened my mind from its slumber, and have instilled sweet hope into my breast. I could not, I dared not, I have not till now called you my sister, because I could not be your brother, because we were not equal, because you are mistaken in me. But you see, I am writing all the while of myself. In this moment of fearful misery, I am thinking only of myself, though I know that you are worrying about me. Oh, do not worry about me, my dear one. If you only knew how humiliated I am in my own eyes. It has all been discovered. What a fuss there has been. You will be an outcast on my account. Contempt. Jeers will be showered upon you, because I am so low in their eyes. Oh, how greatly I am to blame for being unworthy of you! If only I had had consequence, personal value in their eyes, if I had inspired more respect in them, they would have forgiven you. But I am low, I am insignificant, I am absurd, and nothing is lower than to be absurd. Who is it that is making a fuss? Because they have begun to make a fuss, I have lost heart. I have always been weak. Do you know the state I am in now? I am laughing at myself, and it seems to me that they are right, because I am absurd and hateful even to myself. I feel that. I hate even my face, my figure, all my habits, all my ignoble ways. I have always hated them. Oh, forgive me my crude despair. You have taught me yourself to tell you everything. I have ruined you. I have brought anger and contempt upon you because I was below you. And this thought, too, tortures me. It is hammering at my brain the whole time and poisons and lacerates my heart. And I keep fancying that you have not loved the man you thought you found in me, that you were deceived in me. That is what hurts. That is what tortures me. And will torture me to death if I do not go out of my mind. Farewell. Farewell. Now, when all has been discovered, after their outcry and their tittle-tattle, I have heard them. When I have been humiliated, degraded in my own eyes, made ashamed of myself, ashamed even of you for your choice. When I have cursed myself, now I must run away and disappear for the sake of your peace. They insist on it, and so you will never see me again, never. It must be so, it is fated. Too much has been given me. Fate has blundered. Now she will correct her mistake and take it all away again. We came together, learned to know each other, and now we are parting till we meet again. When will that be? Where will that be? Oh, tell me, my own, where shall we meet again? Where am I to find you? How am I to know you? Will you know me then? My whole soul is full of you. Oh, why is it? Why should this happen to us? Why are we parting? Teach me. I don't understand. I shall never understand it. Teach me how to tear my life in two, how to tear my heart out of my bosom and to live without it. Ah, when I think that I shall never see you again. Never. Never. My God, what an uproar they have made. How afraid I feel for you now. I have only just met your husband. We are both unworthy of him, though we have neither of us sinned against him. He knows all. He sees us. He understands it all. And even beforehand everything was as clear as day to him. He has championed you heroically. He will save you. He will protect you from this tittle-tattle and uproar. His love and respect for you are boundless. He is your savior, while I am running away. I rushed up to him. I wanted to kiss his hand. He told me that I must go at once. It is settled. I am told that he has quarrelled with them, with everyone on your account. They are all against you. They blame him for weakness and laxity. Oh, my God! What are they not saying about you? They don't know. They cannot understand. They are incapable of it. Oh, forgive them. Forgive them, my poor darling, as I forgive them. And they have taken from me more than from you. I am beside myself. I don't know what I am writing to you. Of what did I talk to you last night at parting? I have forgotten it all. I was distracted. You were crying. Oh, forgive me those tears. I am so weak, so faint-hearted. There was something else I wanted to tell you. Oh, if only I could once more bathe your hands in tears, as I am bathing this letter now. If I could be once more at your feet. If only they knew how noble was your feeling. But they are blind. Their hearts are proud and haughty. They do not see it and will never see it. They have no eyes to see. They will not believe that you are innocent, even according to their standards. Not though everything on earth should swear it. As though they could understand. How can they fling a stone at you? Whose hand will throw the first? Oh, they will feel no shame. They will fling thousands of stones. They will fling them boldly, for they know how to do it. They will all throw them at once, and will say that they are without sin, and will take the sin on themselves. Oh, if they knew what they are doing! If only one could tell them everything without concealment, so that they might see, might hear, might understand and be convinced. But no, they are not so spiteful. I am in despair now. I am perhaps unjust to them. I am perhaps frightening you with my terror. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of them, my own. They will understand you. One at least understands you already. Have hope. It is your husband. Goodbye. Goodbye. I will not thank you. Goodbye forever. S.O.
My confusion was so great that for a long time I did not know what was happening to me. I was shaken and terrified.
Reality had fallen upon me unawares in the midst of the easy life of dreams on which I had lived for 3 years. I felt with horror that there was a great secret in my hands, and that that secret was binding my whole existence. How? I did not know that yet myself. I felt that from that moment a new future was beginning for me. I had now, not of my own choice, become too close a participator in the life and relations of the people who had hitherto made up the whole world surrounding me, and I was afraid for myself. How should I enter their life, I, unbidden, I, a stranger to them? What should I bring them? How would these fetters which had so suddenly riveted me to another person's secret be loosened? How could I tell? Perhaps my new part would be painful both for me and for them. I could not be silent. I could not refuse the part and lock what I had learned in my heart for ever. But how would it be, and what would become of me? What was I to do? And what was it that I had found out, indeed? Thousands of questions, still vague and confused, rose up before me, and were already an unbearable weight upon my heart. I felt utterly lost. Then, I remember, came another phase with new, strange impressions I had not experienced before. I felt as though something were loosened in my bosom, as though my old misery had suddenly fallen off my heart, and something new had begun to fill it. Something such as I did not know yet whether to grieve or rejoice at. The moment was like that when a man leaves his home for ever, and a life hitherto calm and unruffled, for a far unknown journey, and for the last time looks round him, inwardly taking leave of his past, and at the same time feels a bitterness at heart from a mournful foreboding of the unknown future, perhaps gloomy and hostile, which awaits him on his new path. At last, convulsive sobs broke from my bosom and relieved my heart with hysterical weeping. I wanted to see someone, to hear someone, to hold someone tight, tight. I could not remain alone. I did not want solitude now. I flew to Alexandra Mihailovna and spent the whole evening with her. We were alone. I asked her not to play, and refused to sing in spite of her asking me. Everything seemed irksome to me, and I could not settle to anything. I believe we both shed tears. I only remember that I quite frightened her. She besought me to be calm, not to be agitated. She watched me in alarm, telling me that I was ill, and that I did not take care of myself. At last, utterly exhausted and shattered, I left her. I was as though in delirium. I went to bed in a fever. Several days passed before I could recover myself and consider my position more clearly. At this time, Alexandra Mihailovna and I were living in complete isolation. Pyotr Alexandrovich was not in Petersburg. He had gone to Moscow on business and spent 3 weeks there. Though the separation was so short, Alexandra Mihailovna sank into terrible depression. At times she grew more serene, but she shut herself up alone, so that even my society must have been a burden to her. Moreover, I tried to be alone myself. My brain was working with feverish activity. I was like one possessed. At times, hours of long, agonizingly disconnected reverie came upon me. It was as though I were dreaming that someone was laughing at me on the sly, as though something had taken possession of me that poisoned and confounded every thought. I could not shake off the distressing images that were continually appearing before me and giving me no peace. I was haunted by pictures of prolonged, hopeless suffering, martyrdom, sacrifice endured submissively, unrepiningly and fruitlessly. It seemed to me that he for whom the sacrifice was made scorned it and laughed at it. It seemed to me that I had seen a criminal forgiving the sins of the righteous, and my heart was torn. At the same time I longed to be rid of my suspicion. I cursed it. I hated myself because all my convictions were not convictions, but simply intuitions, because I could not justify my impressions to myself.
Then I went over in my mind those phrases, those last shrieks of terrible farewell. I pictured that man, not her equal. I tried to grasp all the agonizing meaning of those words, not her equal. That despairing farewell made an agonizing impression upon me. I am absurd, and am myself ashamed of your choice. What did that mean? What people were these? What were they grieving over? What were they miserable about? What had they lost? Mastering myself with an effort, I read again with strained attention the letter which was so full of heart-rending despair, though its meaning was so strange, so difficult for me to understand. But the letter fell from my hands, and my heart was more and more overcome by violent emotion. All this was bound to end in some way, but I did not see the way out, or was afraid of it. I was almost seriously ill when the carriage rumbled one day into the courtyard, bringing Pyotr Alexandrovitch, who had returned from Moscow. Alexandra Mihailovna flew to meet her husband with a cry of joy, but I stood as though rooted to the spot. I remember that I was struck myself by my own sudden emotion. I could not control myself and rush to my room. I did not understand why I was so suddenly alarmed, but I was frightened at this alarm. A quarter of an hour later, I was summoned and given a letter from Prince X. In the drawing-room I found a stranger whom Pyotr Alexandrovitch had brought with him from Moscow, and from some words which I caught, I learned that he was to stay with us for a long time. He was Prince X's agent, who had come to Petersburg about some very important business of the family, which Pyotr Alexandrovitch had been looking after for some time. He gave me a letter from Prince X, and told me that the young princess wanted to write to me also, and had assured him to the last moment that the letter would be ready, but had sent him away empty-handed, begging him to tell me that it was absolutely no use for her to write to me, that one could write nothing in a letter, that she had spoilt 5 sheets of paper and had torn them all up, that to begin writing to each other we should have to make friends over again. Then she charged him to tell me that she would soon be seeing me. The unknown gentleman answered to my impatient questions that the news of our meeting soon was quite correct, and that the whole family was preparing to visit Petersburg shortly. I did not know what to do for joy at this information. I hastened to my room, locked myself in, and dissolved into tears as I opened the prince's letter. The prince promised me that I should soon see him and Katya, and with deep feeling congratulated me on my talent. Finally, he gave me his blessing and best wishes for the future, which he promised to provide for. I wept as I read this letter, but with those tears of joy was mingled such an insufferable sadness that I remember I was alarmed at myself. I did not know what was happening to me. Several days passed. The newcomer used now to be working every morning and often in the evening till after midnight, in the room next to mine, where Pyotr Alexandrovitch's secretary used to be. Often this gentleman and Pyotr Alexandrovitch shut themselves into the latter's study and worked together. One day Alexandra Mihailovna told me to go into her husband's study and ask him whether he would come and have tea with us. Finding no one in the study, and expecting Pyotr Alexandrovitch to come back shortly, I remained waiting for him. His portrait was hanging on the wall. I remember that I shuddered as I looked at the portrait, and with an excitement I could not myself understand, I began scrutinizing it intently. It was hung rather high up. Moreover, it was beginning to get dark, and to see it better I pushed a chair up and stood on it. I wanted to detect something, as though I hoped to find the solution of my doubts. And I remember what struck me first of all was the eyes in the portrait. It struck me at once that I had never seen the eyes of this man before. He always kept them hidden behind spectacles. Even in my childhood I had disliked the way he looked at people, through some strange, unaccountable prejudice. But now that prejudice seemed to be justified. My imagination was worked up. It suddenly seemed to me as though the eyes of the portrait, in confusion, turned away from my searching, inquisitorial gaze, that they were trying to avoid it, that there was lying and duplicity in those eyes. It seemed to me that I had guessed right, and I cannot explain the secret joy that stirred in me at having guessed right. A faint cry broke from me. At that moment I heard a rustle behind me. I looked round. Pyotr Alexandrovich was standing behind me, staring at me. I fancied that he reddened. I turned hot all over and jumped down from the chair.
"What are you doing here?"
he asked in a stern voice.
"Why are you here?"
I did not know what to answer. Recovering myself a little, I gave him Alexandra Mihalovna's message after a fashion. I don't know what answer he made me. I don't remember how I got out of the room, but when I reached Alexandra Mihalovna I had completely forgotten the answer for which she was waiting, and said at a venture that he was coming.
"But what is the matter with you, Nietochka?" she asked. "You are crimson. Look at yourself. What's the matter with you?" "I don't know. I have been running quickly," I answered.
"What did Pyotr Alexandrovich say to you?" she interrupted, troubled. I did not answer. At that moment Pyotr Alexandrovich's steps were heard, and I immediately walked out of the room. I waited for 2 full hours in great perturbation. At last I was summoned to Alexandra Mihalovna. I found her silent and preoccupied. As I went in she bent a rapid, searching glance upon me, but at once dropped her eyes. I fancied that some embarrassment was reflected in her face. I soon noticed that she was in low spirits. She spoke little, did not look at me at all, and in reply to B.'s anxious inquiries, said she had a headache. Pyotr Alexandrovich was more talkative than usual, but he talked only to B. Alexandra Mihalovna went absent-mindedly to the piano.
"Seeing something,"
said B., turning to me.
"Yes, Annetta, sing your new song,"
Alexandra Mihalovna chimed in, as though catching at the idea. I glanced at her. She looked at me in uneasy suspense. But I could not control myself. Instead of going to the piano and singing something, I was overcome with confusion, and in my embarrassment could not even think how to excuse myself. At last annoyance got the upper hand, and I refused point-blank.
"Why don't you want to sing?"
said Alexandra Mihalovna, with a significant glance at me and a fleeting one at her husband. Those 2 glances drove me out of all patience. I got up from the table in complete confusion, no longer concealing it, but shaking with a feeling of impatience and annoyance. I repeated with heat that I did not want to, I could not, that I was not well. As I said this, I looked them all in the face. But God knows how I longed at that moment to be in my own room and to hide myself from them all. B was surprised. Alexandra Mihalovna was visibly distressed and did not say a word. But Pyotr Alexandrovich suddenly got up from his chair and said that he had forgotten some work, and evidently vexed that he had wasted valuable time, went hurriedly out of the room, saying that he would perhaps look in later, but at the same time, in case he did not, he shook hands with B by way of good-bye.
"What's the matter with you?"
B asked.
"You look really ill."
"Yes, I am unwell, very unwell,"
I answered impatiently.
"Yes, you certainly are pale, and just now you were so flushed," observed Alexandra Mihalovna, and she suddenly checked herself.
"Do stop," I said, going straight up to her and looking her in the face. The poor thing could not face my eyes. She dropped hers as though she were guilty, and a faint flush suffused her pale cheeks. I took her hand and kissed it. Alexandra Mihalovna looked at me with a show of naive pleasure.
"Forgive me for having been such an ill-tempered, naughty child today," I said with feeling. "But I really am ill. Let me go, and don't be angry." "We are all children," she said with a timid smile. "And indeed, I am a child too, and worse, much worse than you," she added in my ear. "Good night, be well. Only for God's sake don't be cross with me." "What for?" I asked.
I was so struck by this naive entreaty. "What for?" she repeated, greatly confused and even frightened at herself. "What for? Why, you see what I am like, Nyetochka. What did I say to you? Good night. You are cleverer than I am, and I am worse than a child." "Come, that's enough," I answered, much moved and not knowing what to say to her. Kissing her at once, I went hurriedly out of the room. I felt horribly vexed and sad. Moreover, I was furious with myself, feeling that I was not on my guard and did not know how to behave. I was ashamed to the point of tears and fell asleep in the depths of depression. When I woke up in the morning, my first thought was that the whole previous evening was a pure creation of the imagination, a mirage, that we had only been mystifying each other, that we had been in a nervous flutter, had made a regular adventure out of a trifle, and that it was all due to inexperience and our not being used to receiving external impressions. I felt that the letter was to blame for it all, that it was disturbing me too much, and that my imagination was overwrought, and I made up my mind for the future that I had better not think about anything. Settling all my trouble with such exceptional ease, and fully convinced that I could as easily act as I had resolved, I felt calmer, and set off to my singing lesson in quite a cheerful mood. The morning air completely cleared away my headache. I was very fond of my morning walks to my lessons. It was so enjoyable going through the town, which was already by 9 o'clock full of life, and was busily beginning its daily round. We usually went by the liveliest and busiest streets, and I delighted in this background for the beginning of my artistic life. The contrast between this petty everyday life, these trivial but living cares, and the art which was awaiting me 2 paces away from this life. On the third story of a huge house crowded from top to bottom with inhabitants who, as it seemed to me, had nothing whatever to do with any art. These busy, cross passers-by, among whom I moved with my music book under my arm, old Natalia who escorted me and always unconsciously set me trying to solve the riddle of what she was thinking about, then my teacher, a queer fellow, half Italian and half French, at moments a genuine enthusiast, far more often a pedant, and most of all a money-grubber. All this entertained me and made me laugh or ponder. Moreover, I loved music, with timid but passionate hope, built castles in the air, fashioned for myself the most marvellous future, and often, as I came back, was fired by my own imaginings. In fact, at those hours I was almost happy. I had just such a moment that day when at 10 o'clock I was coming home from my lesson. I had forgotten everything, and I remember I was absorbed in some joyful dream. But all at once, as I was going upstairs, I started as though I was scalded. I heard above me the voice of Pyotr Alexandrovich, who at that moment was coming downstairs. The unpleasant feeling that came over me was so intense, the memory of yesterday's incident impressed me so disagreeably, that I could not conceal my discomfort. I made a slight bow to him, but my face was probably expressive at the moment, for he stopped short, facing me in surprise. Noticing his movement, I flushed crimson and went hurriedly upstairs. He muttered something after me and went his way. I was ready to cry with vexation, and could not understand what it was that had happened. I was not myself all the morning, and did not know what course to take in order to make an end of it, and be rid of it all as quickly as possible. 1,000 times I vowed to myself to be more sensible, and 1,000 times I was overwhelmed with dread of what I might do. I felt that I hated Alexandra Mihalovna's husband, and yet at the same time I was in despair over my own behaviour. Continual agitation made me quite unwell on this occasion, and I was utterly unable to control myself. I felt vexed with everyone. I sat in my room all the morning, and did not even go to Alexandra Mihalovna. She came to see me. She almost cried out when she glanced at me. I was so pale that I was frightened myself when I looked in the looking-glass. Alexandra Mihalovna stayed a whole hour with me, looking after me as though I were a little child. But her attention made me so depressed. Her kindness weighed upon me so.
It was such an agony to look at her that at last I asked her to leave me alone. She went away in great anxiety about me. At last my misery found a vent in tears and hysterics. Towards evening I felt better. Better because I made up my mind to go to her. I made up my mind to fall on my knees before her, to give her the letter she had lost, and to tell her about everything, to tell her about all the agonies I had endured, all my doubts, to embrace her with the boundless love that glowed in my heart, for her, my martyr, to tell her that I was her child, her friend, that my heart was open to her, that she must look into it and see the ardent, steadfast feeling for her in it. My God! I knew, I felt, that I was the last to whom she could open her heart, but it seemed to me that that made the salvation more certain, and would make the effect of my words more powerful. Though vaguely and obscurely, I did understand her sufferings, and my heart boiled with indignation at the thought that she might blush before me, before my judgment. Poor darling! My poor darling, as though you were the sinner. That's what I should say to her, weeping at her feet. My sense of justice was revolted. I was furious. I don't know what I should have done, but I only came to my senses afterwards when an unexpected incident saved me and her from disaster by checking me at my first step. Then I was horrified. Could her tortured heart have risen to hope again? I should have killed her at one blow. This is what happened. I was on my way to her study, and only two rooms from it, when Pyotr Alexandrovitch came in by a side door, and, not noticing me, went on before me. He, too, was going to see her. I stood stock still. He was the last person I wanted to meet at such a moment. I wanted to get away, but curiosity kept me rooted to the spot. He stood for a minute before the looking-glass, arranged his hair, and to my intense astonishment, I suddenly heard him begin humming a tune. Instantly, an obscure, faraway incident of my childhood rose to my memory. To understand the strange sensation I felt at that moment, I will describe the incident. It was an incident that made a profound impression upon me in the first year of my living in that house, although only now its significance became clear. For only now, only at this moment, I realized what was the origin of my unaccountable aversion for the man. I have already mentioned that even in those days I always felt ill at ease with him. I have already described the depressing effect on me of his frowning, anxious air, and the expression of his face so frequently melancholy and dejected. How unhappy I was after the hours we spent together at Alexandra Mihalovna's tea-table, and what agonizing misery rent my heart on two or three occasions when it was my lot to witness the gloomy, sinister scenes which I have referred to already. It happened that I came upon him then just as I had done now, in the same room, at the same time, when he, like me, was going to see Alexandra Mihalovna. I had been overcome with purely childish shyness of meeting him alone, and so hid in a corner as though I had done something wrong, praying to fate that he might not notice me. Just as now, he had stopped before the looking-glass, and I shuddered with a vague, unchildlike feeling. It seemed to me as though he were making up his face. Anyway, I had clearly seen a smile on his face before he went to the looking-glass. I saw him laughing, as I had never seen him before, for I remember that it was this that had struck me most of all. He never laughed in the presence of Alexandra Mihalovna. But as soon as he looked in the looking-glass, his face was completely transformed. The smile disappeared as though at the word of command, and his lips were twisted by some bitter feeling, which seemed to spring from the heart spontaneously against his will, a feeling which it seemed beyond human power to disguise, in spite of the most magnanimous efforts. A paroxysm of pain brought lines into his forehead and seemed to weigh upon his brow. His eyes were darkly concealed behind spectacles. In short, he seemed as though at a given signal to be changed into a different man. I remember that I, as a little child, shuddered with fear from dread of understanding what I had seen, and from that time an uncomfortable, disagreeable impression was stored away in my heart forever. After looking at himself for a minute in the looking-glass, he, with bent head and bowed figure,
looking as he always did before Alexandra Mihalovna, went on tiptoe to her study. This was the incident that had struck me in the past. Now, just as then, he stopped before the same looking-glass and thought that he was alone. Just as then, I, with a hostile, unpleasant feeling, found myself alone with him. But when I heard that singing from him from whom it was so impossible to expect anything of the kind, which struck me as so unexpected that I stood as though rooted to the spot when at that very instant I was reminded of the almost exactly similar moment of my childhood, I cannot describe the malignant feeling that went through my heart. All my nerves quivered, and in response to this luckless song, I went off into such a peal of laughter that the poor singer, uttering a cry, stepped 2 paces back from the looking-glass, and, pale as death, as though ignominiously caught in the act, looked at me, beside himself with alarm, wonder, and fury. His expression affected me nervously. I replied to it with a nervous, hysterical laugh right in his face. I walked by him laughing, and, still laughing, went in to Alexandra Mihalovna. I knew that he was standing behind the curtains over the door, that he was perhaps hesitating whether to come in or not, that he was rooted to the spot by rage and cowardice, and with a nervous, defiant impatience, I wanted to see what he would do. I was ready to bet that he would not come in, and I was right. He did not come in till 30 minutes later. Alexandra Mihalovna looked at me for a long time in the utmost perplexity, but her inquiries as to what was the matter with me were fruitless. I could not answer. I was gasping for breath. At last she understood that I was in hysterics, and looked after me anxiously. When I had recovered, I took her hands and began kissing them. Only then I grasped the position, and only then the thought occurred to me that I should have been the death of her if it had not been for the encounter with her husband. I looked at her as one risen from the dead.